If you're like me, sometimes you need a break when listening to true crime. Well, what could be better than a mobile puzzle game filled with cute characters? I'm sure you've already heard of Best Fiends. There's over 100 million global downloads. It truly seems like everybody is playing it, and I think that you should too. They've even sponsored today's episode of Morbidology. As you make your way through the levels, you collect cute little monsters that you can evolve. Best Fiends is super easy to follow and fun to play, making it the perfect game for both adults and children. It's a casual game that won't stress you out, and it's very easy to pass the time with. I find myself playing it before bed, and when I'm out walking my dog. I'm already on level 261. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. In 1999, a young woman was knocked off her bicycle by a man driving a truck along a lonely Ohio country road. The man attempted to abduct the young woman, but miraculously, she escaped and flagged down a passing motorist. Almost 3 decades later, an eerily similar attack would occur along another lonely Ohio country road. This time, however, the young woman wouldn't be as lucky. On the 19th of July 2016, 20-year-old Sierra Jockin was reported missing in Delta, Ohio. She had set out that evening on her purple bicycle to go to her boyfriend's house, and when she didn't arrive home, her mother, Sheila Vakulik, contacted police to file a missing person report at around 11 p.m. As she later said, "As Sierra's mother, I knew there was something seriously wrong, and time was of the essence." Sierra had been a student at the University of Toledo since 2014 and was just entering her junior year, studying human resources management. She was also working as a summer intern for a company that her uncle, Howard Ice, owned, and was a proud member of the University of Toledo's professional business fraternity, where she helped plan professional development opportunities, including scheduling speakers and hosting events. As Patrick Northcraft, the chapter's president, said, "She was a beautiful and fantastic individual who worked tirelessly to make sure that fellow members were on top of their grades and other responsibilities." Those who knew Sierra described her as being one of the most kind-hearted and nicest people you could ever come across, as well as being determined and hard-working. She had a warmth and vibrancy that instantly drew people in, and she cared deeply for her family. Her aunt, Tara Ice, said that Sierra was fun to be around, but was also serious beyond her years. She said, "She had a way of making everybody feel comfortable, even a person who's an introvert and shy. She'd bring that person out." Missing person posters described Sierra as standing around 5 feet 5 inches tall and weighing around 130 pounds, with brown hair and brown eyes. When she vanished, she was wearing shorts and a neon yellow tank top and riding a purple bicycle. a large search party was assembled, consisting of around 140 volunteers, that fanned out over the wide rural area to search for Sierra, or any evidence of where she went. The search party was based from the Metamora Amboy Volunteer Fire Department, and they trudged through 75 acres in the area that surrounded country roads S, T, and 6. They searched ponds and creeks, as well as checked on drains. They also flagged down passing motorists to hand them flyers and ask if they had seen anything suspicious. Investigators were quick to announce that Sierra's boyfriend, Josh Kolosinski, was not a suspect in her disappearance. Sierra had visited his home, and when she left on her bicycle, he had rode alongside her on his motorcycle. A number of people in the area had seen Sierra and her boyfriend that evening, and investigators were able to determine that the last time she was seen was around 6:45 p.m. as she cycled in the Evergreen School District. Sierra and her boyfriend had parted ways near Country Road 6. She continued on the road as he turned around to drive back home. Shortly after midnight, Sierra's abandoned purple bicycle was found around four rows into a cornfield located on Country Road 6. Fulton County Sheriff Roy Miller said that there appeared to be some kind of struggle at the area where her bicycle was found. All of the corn surrounding the bicycle had been trampled on. The cornfield was just around the corner from Sierra's family home. The area was cordoned off while an Ohio State Highway patrol plane, equipped with night vision, scoured the area overhead, but failed to find any sign of Sierra. A number of items found at the scene with Sierra's bicycle were sent off to a lab to be analysed, but the sheriff refused to elaborate on what these items were. He additionally said that Sierra's disappearance was of suspicious nature, but he stopped short of saying that she had been abducted or saying that foul play was involved. He stated, "I don't know that this is truly an abduction. We don't know what it is yet. It's just a suspicious disappearance at this time. In our mind, we're going to support the family. We're going to do everything we can do, utilize all of our resources to continue looking for her." Almost as soon as Sierra's bicycle was found discarded in a cornfield, rumors began to circulate around the area that she had been abducted for human trafficking purposes. Sheriff Miller was quick to discount these rumors, stating that it was very unlikely and that younger, more susceptible females were typically targeted for that specific crime. The sheriff's office would soon enough request the assistance of the FBI and would call in a sniffer dog. Following the discovery of the bicycle, the searchers focused their attention mainly on the cornfield surrounding the area, while investigators kept the intersection of County Road T and County Road S blocked off, restricting travel northbound past where Sierra's bicycle was found. The area outside Sierra's family home became a meeting point for the volunteer searchers, and from here they grabbed handfuls of missing person flyers and handed them out to residents and stopped cars to inquire as to whether anybody had seen Sierra. Her aunt, Carrie Jockin, briefly spoke with the Blade and said that it was hurtful because nobody had any idea why Sierra had vanished or who could have caused her to vanish, stating, "You want one good, solid answer." According to everybody who knew Sierra, she would never have run away to start a new life, and she had no enemies whatsoever. The sheriff announced that he was grateful for all of the assistance from the locals, and that the large search party had made him feel optimistic that they were going to find Sierra. He also asked for people in the area who had CCTV cameras set up outside their homes to check the footage back and see if they had captured Sierra on her cycle home. Since the area where Sierra was last spotted was near the Ohio-Michigan border, investigators announced that she may have crossed over to Michigan. The Evergreen School District was around 80 miles south of Detroit and less than 10 miles away from the border of Michigan. The search was still focusing around this area. Since this was where Sierra's bicycle was found, it seemed like the most logical place to search. As hundreds of volunteers scoured through the cornfields, they were hit by the hot summer heat. Despite the exhaustive and extensive search, They were unable to find any clues which could help them find Sierra, or find out what happened to her. Meanwhile, a private donor offered up a $25,000 reward for information which could lead to Sierra. This reward would then be increased to $100,000. A candlelight vigil was held inside the Lyons Community Ballpark on the Wednesday evening, and over 300 people attended and prayed for the safe return of Sierra. Paul Bishop, a family friend, said that the family appreciated the outpouring of support from the community, as well as the support of the investigators working around the clock to bring Sierra back home. Just the following morning, investigators announced that they were wanting to track down a jogger who may have seen Sierra shortly before she was reported missing. They also announced that they were wanting to speak to anybody who saw a motorcyclist wearing a black, open-faced, no-shield helmet who was riding on County Road 6 near County Road T between 6:30 p.m. and 8 p.m. on the evening that Sierra vanished. That same day, it would be announced that a man had been arrested on an abduction charge linked to Sierra's disappearance. The man would be identified as 57-year-old James Wardley. James had been born in Tacoma, Washington in 1959. He graduated from Evergreen High School in Metamora in 1978 with a 1.59 grade point average. Beginning when he was just 14 years old, James sold marijuana until 1984. He had worked for a while at Art Iron Incorporated in Toledo before moving on to the Schinninger Incorporated. He was employed for a while at Vulcan Industries and left in 1986 when the plant closed down. He worked for 3 years for a farmer in the area and served on the grounds crew for a number of county fairs. For a number of years, he moved from job to job, and in 1989, his mother purchased him a professional mower for his new lawn business. Most recently, he had operated FES Shop Services from his home. He was licensed from March of 2010 until December of 2012 as a driveway operator for a trailer transporter. Investigators had obtained a search warrant to search his home, which was located in rural Fulton Township. Sierra still hadn't been found, and many speculated that the arrest of a suspect would lead to Sierra. A quick check of James' criminal record would show that he had been arrested for an eerily similar crime back in 1990. James had pleaded guilty to abduction, which was an aggravated felony in the first degree. Coincidentally, in this case, James had abducted a woman on a bicycle. His victim was Robin Gardner, and she had been cycling on OB Road near White House on the 4th of July 1990. As she cycled along the road, a truck passed her in the opposite direction. A couple of moments later, that same truck struck her from behind, causing her to fall off her bicycle and into a ditch alongside a cornfield. The driver was James. He got out of his truck and approached Robin and asked if she was okay, before striking her on the head with some kind of heavy object. James then dragged Robin over to his truck and threatened to do what he asked of her or he would kill her. He forced Robin into his truck and placed a handcuff on one of her wrists. Robin thankfully managed to break free from the handcuff and escaped out of the driver's door. A passing motorcyclist picked her up, took her home, and then the police were called. She had sustained a concussion, a skull fracture, and a number of bruises and cuts. She was understandably left traumatized by the ordeal and would eventually move out of state. James was arrested around a week after the attack, and he was sentenced to between 4 and 10 years in prison. He served just 3 years before being paroled in December of 1993. Then in 2000, James pleaded guilty to illegal manufacture of cultivation of marijuana, as well as having weapons while under disability, both of which were felonies. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison. Sheriff Miller would say during a press conference that James had become a suspect through good old-fashioned investigative work, but he didn't elaborate any further. The 3-acre property where James lived soon enough became flooded with investigators, as well as a forensic diving team. His home was located on County Road 6, surrounded by cornfields with a small lake on the grounds, which was now going to be searched for any signs of Sierra. Meanwhile, James was taken to the Fulton County Western District Court, where he stood before Judge Jeffrey Robinson and requested a court-appointed attorney, stating that he had only made $1,000 the past year. He then requested an attorney, Mark Powers, who had represented James in the past. In making that request, he stated, "I need to speak to someone that I know and trust. I don't know of a more honest person." According to the complaint that was filed, James, without privilege to do so, did knowingly, by force or threat, remove another person from the place where she was found. Just the next day, the update that Sierra's family had been dreading came, when it was announced that a body had been recovered in a shallow grave in a cornfield along County Road 7, just a few miles southwest of James's home.
Authorities searching an area around County Road 7 tragically found what we believe to be Sierra's remains. Positive identification will be made through either fingerprints or DNA, but at this time, we strongly believe that this is Sierra. I want to express my heartfelt condolences to Sierra's family. At this time, our investigation will remain ongoing, but we do anticipate additional charges against the suspect.
Sheriff Miller announced that they believed that the body was that of Sierra, but they were waiting for positive identification at the medical examiner's office, as well as a cause of death. He further said that he expected more charges to be filed against James, stating, "This investigation is far from over." The grim announcement came after days of flurried activity, both from volunteer searchers and investigators. It was an update that nobody wanted, but most people had come to accept that the outcome of this case wasn't going to be a positive one, when Sierra wasn't immediately found alive and well inside James's property. The following morning, the congregation of the Holy Trinity Parish in Assumption gathered for the morning mass. The church was just a 10-minute drive from James's home. Reverend Marty Nasser marked the end of the week, a week that was filled with optimism and hope before being shattered into despair and grief. He said, "What does it mean for an abduction and a tragic murder to take place in our midst? What does all of this terribleness mean?" While the body hadn't yet been identified, practically everybody in the area knew that it was Sierra, her family included. On the Monday, the body would be positively identified as Sierra through fingerprints. Back at Sierra's home, her mother was informed of the identification. According to those who were at the home at the time, everybody began to scream and sob, but moments later, Sheila said, "I'm at peace. I know where she is now." The autopsy would conclude that Sierra had died from asphyxiation, from something that had been stuffed inside her mouth. It had been stuffed inside her mouth with such force that it had broken some of her teeth. Her time of death was estimated to be at around 9 p.m. on the 22nd of July, meaning that Sierra had been kept alive for more than 3 days. She had been found in a hog-tied position with her wrists handcuffed and roped behind her back. She was also wearing an adult diaper. The rope extended to her ankles, which were also bound with rope and taped together. There was no evidence that Sierra had been raped. James would subsequently be charged with aggravated murder, and Attorney General Mike DeWine would say that they were looking into whether James had other victims, as well as Sierra and Robin. The two cases were so similar, and it was evident that James had a modus operandi. Robin came forward and said that she believed that James had targeted other women, both before and after her, and that the attack had made her terrified of walking into the woods alone. Amber Van Gooten, a lawyer from Delta, said that when she heard of the murder, her mind immediately thought back to the unsolved murder of Laurie Ann Hill. Laurie was just a 14-year-old freshman at Swanton High when she vanished on the 25th of October 1985, after attending a Halloween party. She was last spotted walking along South Berkeley Southern Road in the direction of her home, but she never arrived. Her body would be found 4 days later in a wooded area. Lawyer Van Gutten made a request to have James's DNA compared to the male DNA that was found on Laurie's body. Back in 2012, lawyer Van Gutten had represented Walter Zimbeck, who was a former boyfriend of Laurie who went on trial for her murder. The jury had been unable to reach a verdict and the prosecution decided not to retry. DNA from the crime scene did not match Walter's. This would just be the first of a number of murders that investigators would try to link to James. It's easy to become overwhelmed and confused by all of the variations of teeth whitening that are out there on the market. Well, today's episode is sponsored by the amazing Smile Brilliant. They've taught me some useful information that alleviates some of that confusion, such as, did you know that LED lights are simply a novelty item? That strip lights neglect the gum lines, crevices, and molars? The charcoal is abrasive and wears down the enamel, and that whitening toothpaste only works on surface stains. Dentists always recommend that the number one product is a custom-fitted tray. However, they're super expensive and require a dentist to make them by hand, with a model of your teeth. That's where Smile Brilliant comes in. With Smile Brilliant's Lab Direct process, you can have custom-fitted teeth whitening trays at a fraction of the price, without ever going to the dentist. They will use an exact model of your teeth to handcraft you a personalized tray, ensuring the best possible result. All you do is make your own dental impressions at home and then return them to Smile Brilliant using the prepaid envelope they provide. It really couldn't be simpler and is a fraction of the price of the dentist. Just head on over to smilebrilliant.com or click the link in my show notes and use promo code Morbidology for 30% off. Today's sponsor of Morbidology is Care Of, which is a wellness brand that makes it simple to maintain health goals with a customized vitamin plan. All of their products are formulated with clean ingredients, which are backed by science. They're super transparent about the research and sourcing behind each product. At Care Of, you do an online quiz about your diet, lifestyle, and any health concerns that you may have to help address your specific wellness goals. I personally took the quiz because I needed some vitamins that could help with my skin, hair, and brain. They recommended a number of vitamins, including vegetarian collagen, to help improve my skin, vegetarian omega to help improve my hair, and American ginseng to help with my short-term memory, as well as a couple of others. Once you get your recommendations, they come in daily individual wrapped packets. It takes the hassle out of purchasing numerous bottles of vitamins. Care Of is really like having a one-on-one consultation with a nutritionalist without ever leaving the house. It couldn't be any simpler to take control of your health with Care Of. And Morbidology listeners get a special promo code. For 50% off your first Care Of order, go to takecareof.com and enter code Morbidology50. That is promo code Morbidology50 at takecareof.com. In the aftermath of the discovery, Senator Randy Gardner and Senator Cliff Height announced that they were working on a proposed violent offender registry for Ohio. A number of other states already had violent offender registries, much similar to a sex offender registry. The purpose of such a registry was to inform and warn the public of any violent individuals who may be living in their area. In a news release, they said, "We have an obligation to do what we can to listen to the concerns and anxieties of the people we represent while working with law enforcement to best achieve enhanced safety and public awareness." Towards the end of the month, it was revealed that when searching James's home, investigators had found a hidden room inside a barn, which was kitted out with restraints as well as a carpet-lined freezer with blood inside. The hidden room was kept under bales of hay and was locked from the inside. It also contained a mattress and sex toys. Investigators had also found several pairs of women's underwear on the property, some of which had blood on them. There was also firearms and ammunition and various items of clothing and jewellery. They also found two sets of handcuffs, rope, tape, and recording equipment, as well as some duct tape, which forensic testing showed that it contained both Sierra and James's DNA. In addition, investigators found zip ties and a ski mask inside James's truck. According to the court document, cell phone data showed that James was at the spot where Sierra's bicycle was found for 2 hours on the day that she vanished, and that when he was first questioned by investigators who were canvassing the area, they noticed that he had marks on his arms and bruising to his lower legs. He told investigators that he didn't steal or kill anyone. He then said that his motorcycle had broken down, and he pushed it into a cornfield and somehow lost his helmet, screwdriver, sunglasses, and fuses along the way. Those items were the items of interest which had been found alongside Sierra's bicycle, as well as a blood-stained motorcycle helmet. When James was informed that the helmet had been found, he acted surprised.
Let's talk to them about the helmet.
What about the helmet? You found the helmet?
Yes.
Okay, where's the helmet at? Who had it?
Who had it? Along the road.
You found it along the road?
No, I didn't find it. Someone did.
Well, bring it on here, because I want my helmet back.
Well, that's why we're here, mostly, is because the helmet looks like it might have some blood on it.
James had also said to investigators that he had found 2 bicycles in the area where Sierra had disappeared from, and said that he had touched one of the bicycles, so if investigators found his fingerprints on the bicycle, that would be why. The grim discovery led to more speculation that James was involved in other attacks and even other murders. Investigators would say in court documents that James fit the profile of a serial offender. Sergeant Matthew Smithmeyer said that based on his knowledge and experience of those types of offenders, they will often keep trophies. In fact, it would soon be revealed that after James's previous abduction conviction, he had told a therapist who he was mandated to see by a Lucas County Common Pleas Court judge that he learned from each abduction that he had committed, and that the next one he was going to bury. Ohio requires that mental health professionals disclose credible threats made by their patients to specific victims. However, because the threat was not made against an identified victim, then the therapist felt as though they were not required to break their confidentiality. It appeared as though James was terrified of people breaking into his home and had bombarded the sheriff with complaints of suspicious people. Back in 2014, 2 17-year-old boys had been riding their bicycles along the road when James yelled at them and then followed them to a nearby home. He absolutely terrified the 2 boys, and when questioned by police, James said that he was concerned that they were going to break into his home. On another occasion, he complained that his newspaper had been left on his driveway, as opposed to a designated box. He said he was afraid that people would see the newspaper and believe that he wasn't at home and break in. Other calls from James alerted officers to a neighbour's alarm, a barking dog, a salesman, and suspicious cars. More than likely, James was terrified of someone breaking into his home and uncovering his secret torture dungeon. While there was speculation that he was involved in other murders, investigators would announce that no human remains would be found on his property. On the Saturday, University of Toledo held a vigil to honour Sierra. Parents, faculty and staff showed up to honour her, as well as Sierra's family, who sat in the front row. The president, Sharon Gaber, said to Sierra's parents, "The entire campus community is with you at this time. As a mother and university president and member of this university community, I grieve with you." The group had a gospel reading before Reverend Philip Smith of Corpus Christi University Parish reminded the group of the message, "Love is stronger than death." He said that Sierra was very much loved and loved very much in return, and that she shined a light that would live on forever. Sierra's funeral was held at Christ the World Church, and afterwards she was buried at Amboy Township Cemetery. Her gravestone is surrounded by flowers, trinkets, and 4 small American flags. On the back of the marker are the words, "Your memory is our keepsake." The community really came together in the wake of the murder, and they were determined to create something positive out of the tragedy. Nikki Brubacker and Corey Robertson held a silent auction and a Chinese auction to support Sierra's family. Items for the auction were collected from local businesses as well as from private donors. Hundreds of people showed up to the auction to offer their support, many of whom didn't even know the Jochen family. In mid-August, a grand jury filed a 19-count indictment against James, including 2 counts of abduction, 4 counts of kidnapping, 2 counts of felonious assault, 2 counts of murder, 2 counts of aggravated murder, 2 counts of aggravated robbery, 1 count of possessing criminal tools, 1 count of abuse of a corpse, 1 count of tampering with evidence, and 2 counts of having weapons while under disability. It would also be announced that the prosecution would be seeking the death penalty against James. During the court hearing announcing the charges, Lori Ann Hill's sister, Rachel Hill, was there and said that she wanted a DNA sample from James to determine if he was responsible for the murder of her sister. Rachel sat down and spoke with 24 News.
When Lori died, it killed our family. I truly believe the monster killed Lori. There were marks of bondage on my sister. She was walking, she was alone. Tall, healthy, beautiful young girl. Lori's body was found the same amount of feet, approximately, from the road as Sierra's. Both found within a 6-mile radius of his house. The brutality in which he tortured them.
James would plead not guilty to all of the charges, and he was ordered to stand trial in January of 2018. Meanwhile, around 1,600 people gathered on County Road 6 at Evergreen High School to take part in the event Jochen for Jochen, which was a 5K run and walk, a bicycle route and a self-defence class, all in honour of Sierra. All of the profits generated from the event would go to the Sierra Jochen Memorial Scholarship Fund, which would benefit graduating students from local high schools who would be going to university. The push for the Violent Offender Registry was extremely strong in the aftermath of Sierra's murder. According to statistics, out of the 101,000 people who had been released from prisons in Ohio in 2009 alone, over 33,000 had re-offended. Standing Courageous Incorporated is an organization dedicated to providing awareness and education of interpersonal violence, violent crimes and violent offenders, and they were at the forefront of the debate. They held an event called See the Light at Wildwood Metro Park in Toledo in honor of Sierra and to bring awareness to the Violent Offender Registry. While there were a lot of people who backed such a registry and felt as though it would save lives and make people more aware of who was living near them, there was also those who strongly opposed it and felt as though it would violate civil rights and due process, as well as violate the privacy of the ex-convict. In effect, the ex-convict would never be free of the crime they committed and would never be given a clean slate, so to speak. There are a number of ex-convicts who are rehabilitated and do manage to re-enter society. And as Emily Horowitz, a professor of sociology and criminal justice, said, it doesn't reduce crime, it doesn't make people safer. She also suggested that instead of spending the money on the registry bill, the money should be spent helping offenders re-enter society, which would make them less likely to re-offend. By February, state senators would announce the start of the legislative process to establish Sierra's law, which was the name chosen for the prospective Violent Offender Registry. The senators said that the registry would most likely be coordinated with Ohio's existing sex offender registry and implemented at the county level under the auspices of the Attorney General's office. Felonies which would be included in the registry were murder, attempted murder, voluntary manslaughter, kidnapping, abduction, and repeat violent offenders. The following month, Sierra's family argued for the law before the Ohio State Judiciary Committee. Her mother, Sheila, said that she didn't know if Sierra would still be alive today if her family knew that somebody with a violent criminal past lived nearby. However, she said, the sex offender registry that was put into place by legislators worked just like it was meant to that night. Law enforcement had contact with the offenders in our area within hours after Sierra went missing. But unfortunately, the man indicted for this crime was not on any law or registry, Sierra's family would then file a wrongful death lawsuit against James. The lawsuit said that James was responsible for Sierra's death, and also accused him of fraudulently transferring ownership of his property. According to auditor reports on the 29th of August, James moved the ownership from himself to a trust in which he was the trustee. They were seeking unspecified damages. They wanted to obtain ownership of James's property so that they could demolish it. They had to drive past it almost daily, and it was a heartbreaking reminder of what had happened. In October, revisions were made to the proposed Sierra's Law, which meant that it would only be made available for law enforcement. However, members of the public could still see the Violent Offender Registry if they requested to do so at a sheriff's office. By December time, the murder trial was fast approaching, but in the middle of the month, James's defence lawyer, Mark Burling, asked for the trial date to be pushed back, so that they could process new information and so that James could consider a plea agreement that had been offered by the state. During a pre-trial hearing, it would be revealed that a private investigator who had been hired by James's defence team had unearthed previously unknown information about James during a visit with his sister, who is a police officer. He said that the information learned about James, which was information tracing back to his birth, would be very helpful to the case. The judge agreed, and the murder trial was pushed back until March. If you follow me on social media, you've maybe noticed that I've recently joined the app, Stereo, to offer you guys some bonus live content. Each week, I'm going to be doing live streams about true crime on the app, Stereo. Stereo is a live social conversation app where you can be a co-host, part of the conversation, or just simply listen. It's completely free to download in the App Store, and if you tune into my live streams, you can be part of it by talking with me directly during the live feed. It's completely audio-based, and you don't use your camera, so you can literally join in while you're sitting in your sweatpants in bed, and nobody would have any clue. So join me over on the Stereo app. You can check out my schedule, but I'm going to be live at least once a week. Download the Stereo app and follow me at stereo.com/morbidology. The link is in the description. That is stereo.com/morbidology. On the 11th of March 2018, the murder trial began. During the opening statements, Prosecutor Scott Hasselman informed jurors that he would be presenting hundreds of pieces of evidence which would link James to the murder of Sierra. He said that they had cell phone location technology, DNA, and recorded interviews with James. He said that evidence would place James and Sierra together at key locations, including the spot where Sierra's bicycle was found, on James's property and the cornfield where her body would be found. Turning to the jury, he said, "I simply ask you that you follow the trail of evidence." Defense attorney Merle Detch kept his opening statements short and sweet. He told the jury that the state could not prove beyond a reasonable doubt the essential elements of the case, and asked them to focus on what was not there, because that was just as important.
"We feel that after reviewing all of the exhibits, after hearing the testimony that's put before you, and following the law as it will be given to you by Judge Robinson at the close of this case, we feel that you can come to but one conclusion, and that is that the state of Ohio has not proven each and every essential element beyond a reasonable doubt, and you must make but one finding, and that is findings of not guilty."
James's own words dominated much of the first day of trial. Over 2 hours of interviews between James and investigators were played out for jurors. James said to the investigators that his motorcycle had broken down, and he alternated between pushing it home and riding it home, and said that along the way he had somehow lost his motorcycle helmet, fuses, sunglasses, and screwdriver. He said that he initially told investigators that he had stayed at home all night. However, he later said that he had gone out that night in his truck to try and look for his lost items. He had changed his story when he was informed by investigators that he had been captured on surveillance footage from Evergreen High School. He offered no explanation for the blood that was found on his motorcycle helmet, even when he was told that the blood was determined to be from a female. James completely denied that he was involved in Sierra's disappearance, and at one point even asked, "How do you kidnap or take somebody on a motorcycle?" When questioned about the collection of women's lingerie that was found in his barn, he described the lingerie as girlfriend stuff that he had purchased from China, before later claiming he had planned on shooting amateur pornography with women he met on Craigslist or Backpage. The jury would also hear from those who last saw Sierra alive, including her boyfriend Josh, her mother Sheila, and people who saw her on her final bicycle ride. Josh had driven his motorcycle alongside Sierra as she cycled home, and recollected how when they split up for him to return home, Sierra had told him that she didn't need him by her side. He said he gave her a kiss, said goodbye, and then turned around to drive back home.
We got a few miles down the road and she told me that, you know, she was yelling at me that she didn't need me by her side and that she was fine. And we were at a corner and I gave her a kiss and said bye.
And when you split, where did you go?
I went back home.
And your knowledge would Sierra continue on to the east?
Yes.
Those accurately depict the videos that you took on your ride with Sierra on July 19, 2016?
Yes.
Videos that Josh had taken of himself and Sierra on the ride were played out. Sheila told the jury that when she returned home from work that evening, she noticed that Sierra's bedroom light was off, and then she was informed by Josh that he couldn't get a hold of Sierra. Mary Stein would tell the jury that on the 19th of July, she was returning to Fulton County after visiting a friend in Michigan. She said that she travelled south on County Road 6 between County Road T and the US 120. She said that it was around 7:20 p.m. when she spotted a bicycle lying alongside the road with some kind of light-coloured garment lying beside it. She said that she then noticed a male wearing red shorts and potentially a white t-shirt. He was crouching within several rows of corn, but she couldn't see what he was doing. She only saw him briefly before driving on. During testimony the following day, Special Agent Megan Roberts held up the motorcycle helmet, which was found with Sierra's bicycle. She pointed out reddish-brown stains that were on the helmet and said that the staining appeared to be on both the inside and the outside of the helmet, and that it pretty much covered the entirety of the exterior. She said that there were similar stains on stalks of broken and trampled corn, and on Sierra's bicycle. These stains were later determined to be blood. The prosecution had warned that there would be graphic testimony and photographs before Agent Roberts showed items that were found on Sierra's body, including her bra, white socks, an adult diaper, and a yellow gag. She then showed zip ties found inside two pickup trucks on James's property. BCI Special Agent Dave Hammond then took the jury through some of the items that were found on James's property, including the carpet-lined freezer, which was buried in the floor of the barn, women's lingerie, latex gloves, and adult diapers. He said that adult diapers were also found in several rooms inside James's residence. Scott Hudick, who was the volunteer searcher who found Sierra's body, would take the jury through that distressing moment. He said that he noticed a disturbed area of cornfield on County Road 7 and noticed that there were drag marks around it. He got out of his car to follow the marks and spotted a mound of dirt around 20 to 25 yards into the cornfield with a latex glove laying nearby. He immediately contacted police and Agent Roberts would tell the jury that they then found a grave measuring 4.5 feet by 3 feet. Inside, they found the body of Sierra. BCI Special Agent John Soraya would take the jury through the injuries that James had when he was arrested on the 22nd of July. These injuries included scrapes, cuts, and other marks on his neck, hands, and arms. There would be testimony regarding Google searches that James had made. On the 24th of June 2016, less than a month before Sierra was murdered, James had searched on a pornographic website for the words hogtied and teen. He had also searched for videos using the words rape, forced, hitchhiker, stranded, helpless, and gag. He had searched over 24 pornography websites in the hours leading up to Sierra's disappearance. One of the key witnesses who actually knew James to testify was Lawrence Kreis. He had known James for 30 years. He told the jury that he visited James's home once or twice a month and said that they sometimes watched pornography together. He said that James had shown him some of the lingerie and sex toys and told him that he had planned to build a pornographic studio and make porn. Lawrence said that he didn't believe James when he said that because he had started up a number of businesses in the past, all of which had failed. On cross-examination, he said, "It was just talk. I didn't pay much attention to it." He revealed that James had quit his job to care for his mother and that his brother, Mark, lived in a trailer on the property and was self-sufficient. The fifth day of the trial focused heavily on DNA evidence as well as the cell phone evidence. A forensic scientist testified that Sierra's DNA was found on her bicycle as well as on swabs taken from the cornfield where her bicycle was found. James's DNA was found on a pair of sunglasses that were found with Sierra's bicycle. Sierra's DNA was also found on the motorcycle helmet, which had been recovered beside her bicycle. James's DNA was also found on the same motorcycle helmet. James's DNA was found on a blanket inside his barn, which tested positive for semen, while Sierra's DNA was found on a mattress found inside the barn, as well as on stained paper towels inside the barn. Latex gloves found where Sierra was buried contained both James's and Sierra's DNA. A piece of duct tape also contained both of their DNA. In several instances inside James's barn, including inside the freezer, they had tested presumption positive for blood. However, they had no DNA profile, while other items showed that there was some DNA present, but it was insufficient for conclusive findings. The jury would then hear from Joseph Jensen, who was an FBI agent who worked in the Cellular Analyst Survey team. He explained how records can be matched from cell phones to cell towers to obtain locations. Through the activity on both Sierra's phone and on James's phone, they were able to show that they were together on the evening that Sierra vanished. Next up would be more graphic testimony, this time from Dr. Cynthia Bessier, who conducted Sierra's autopsy. She presented autopsy photographs and described the binding marks to Sierra's body and contusions to her left leg. She also described a laceration on Sierra's forehead, a broken upper left incisor in her mouth, and a hairline fracture to her skull. She detailed how a foreign yellow object was placed in Sierra's mouth and attached to a binding around the back of her neck. She said that this object asphyxiated Sierra and that could have taken her around 10 minutes to die. Dr. Bessier said that the hairline fracture could have been caused by a motorcycle helmet. During the second week of the trial, James's earlier victim, Robin Gardner, recounted her terrifying ordeal. Prosecutors in Ohio are allowed to enter evidence of prior crimes to establish proof of motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity, or absence of mistake or accident. And before Robin testified, Judge Jeffrey Robinson read to jurors a similar advisory. Robin then described how James ran into the back of her in his truck and she crashed into a ditch, telling the jury, "There was nobody around. I thought it was just a freak accident." She said that when she stood up, James appeared and asked if she was okay, before hitting her in the head with a hammer and placing her into a stranglehold. She said that James called her vulgar names and told her to get into his truck, or he was going to kill her. She said that she fought and screamed as he dragged her into his truck and threw her inside.
And I was in the truck at that time, and he was standing on the street, and he put handcuffs on my right wrist, and I didn't want him to get both hands behind my back, so I held onto the steering wheel with my left hand, and we fought and fought to get, he wanted to get both hands behind my back, and I fought and fought and fought. So I finally saw a person coming eastbound
I could see them through the car window. And I was struggling as much as I could so that he could see that I was in distress. Well, he let go of me.
So what happened then?
And then the door closed on the passenger side, and I slid across the seat. And the driver's side door was still open, and I ran out into the street.
What injury did you sustain?
When I got to the hospital, they x-rayed everything, and I had a skull fracture and a concussion.
Miraculously, Robin managed to free herself and run to a passing motorist. During this case, James had stayed at the crime scene and was there when police arrived. And during cross-examination, Defense Detch emphasized that James had stayed at the scene following the incident. Robin would be the final witness to testify for the prosecution. The defense's case was extremely brief. They only called on two witnesses. The first of which was Mark Fable, who had known James since high school. He testified that James had hired him as a driver for his former transportation business. He acknowledged that James owned a 1970s Honda 750 motorcycle and identified the motorcycle helmet found with Sierra's bicycle as one that he had brought for James around 6 years prior. When Prosecutor Hasselman asked Mark if the helmet was stained with blood when he purchased it, he said no. Jeffrey Whitaker then testified that he had known James since high school. He said that they often rode motorcycles together and said that James's motorcycle did have electrical and fuel line issues and would sometimes shake and vibrate. However, under cross-examination, he also said that the problems had never left James stranded in the past. During closing arguments, Prosecutor Hasselman told the jury that looking at all of the facts of the case individually established James' guilt in every case beyond a reasonable doubt. He once again went through all of the items which contained Sierra's DNA that was found on James's property, stating, "The evidence is the argument." He also reminded the jury that James had lied while being interviewed by police, first claiming he was at home all night and then admitting that he had been out that night in his truck. He revealed that the item that had asphyxiated Sierra was a dog toy and suggested he used it knowing that it would take Sierra longer to die, telling the jury he wanted to watch Sierra die. That's why he used a dog toy. Defense Detch then wasted no time in telling the jury to focus on what the state didn't have, and he suggested that they could not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that James was guilty. Prosecutor Hasselman rebutted the statement and reminded the jury that James's DNA was found at every single crime scene involved in the case. The jury were sent away to deliberate, and it took them a mere 4 hours to reach a verdict. They found James Wortley guilty on all of the charges against him. As the verdict was read out, Sierra's loved ones hugged and cried. They were all wearing purple in honour of Sierra, and now justice had been served. It would now be up to the same jury to decide the fate of James, and decide whether he should be sentenced to life in prison or be sentenced to death. During the sentencing phase, defence Mark Burling described James to the jury as one damaged man. He said that James had an alcoholic father who physically abused his mother, Florence, when he was drunk. James's sister, Cynthia Barlow, recollected an incident wherein Florence replaced some alcohol with water, and when he found out, he chased her with a butcher's knife. John Fabian, a forensic and clinical psychologist and neuropathologist, testified that he had met with James before the trial and said that he had a number of mental health issues. He described James as dysfunctional and having psychological issues that were never investigated. He said that as a young child, James would sit on the driveway of the home and just stare into space. He said that he diagnosed him with antisocial personality disorder as well as having a dependence on marijuana. He said that he suffered from low self-esteem, self-doubt, depression, paranoia, and narcissism. He testified that he saw a connection between the fantasy life which was focused around James's obsession with violent porn and the nature of the crime. Dr. Fabian expressed concerns about an inappropriate or even possibly incestuous relationship between James and his mother, although he said that James had denied it and he didn't have enough information for a final determination. Ultimately, the jury were not swayed by the defense's arguments, and they recommended that James be sentenced to death. It had taken them less than 5 hours to reach a unanimous verdict. As the verdict was read out, James showed no emotion. Outside of court, Sierra's uncle, Howard Ice, made a brief statement on behalf of the family, stating, "Obviously, we're pleased with the outcome. We're not a family that would wish for this, but we felt the jury reached the appropriate verdict." It would now be up to the judge to either uphold the death sentence or sentence James to life in prison. During this part of the trial, James decided that he would speak, and he launched into a diatribe about how he was innocent and even offered an alternate theory. He suggested that another man had kidnapped Sierra that evening and had beaten her with the motorcycle helmet which he had allegedly lost. He then claimed that this unknown man then broke into his barn to abuse Sierra. He suggested that despite the fact that Sierra's DNA was found in his barn, the killer walked her to the gravesite and killed her there instead. As he rambled on, members of Sierra's family left the courtroom. Following his statement, Sierra's mother, Sheila, provided an impact statement.
"This was a soul that embraced living and everything that it had to offer. It is hard to put into words the feelings I have experienced over the last year and 9 months. The hole that will never heal in my heart."
"You need a moment, ma'am."
"And my family that I so cherish and am so very proud of will never be the same. I sat in this courtroom and I listened to the actions of a man who intimidated and dominated another human being. A man who acted out a sick and distorted scenario that he had played over and over in his mind. A man that showed no remorse for what happened to my daughter, to what my family was going through, or to what the jurors had to witness during this trial. As a mother, I should never have to explain to my 9 and 11-year-old what capital punishment is. I worry about the memories surrounding Sierra's death. My son was excited to be celebrating his birthday on July 21st, but now that is forever going to be a dark time for him. My youngest daughter was home and witnessed the utter chaos and emotional turmoil that was going on while we frantically tried to figure out what was happening. Their world was shattered, their innocence tainted by this heinous event that happened so close to home."
She spoke about her daughter's achievements before choking up as she said, "For me, the death penalty is what he deserves. Sierra's life was worth more than the 20 years she was able to live." Ultimately, the judge would agree with the jury and sentence James Worley to death. In handing down the sentence, the judge said, "If I thought there was a snowball's chance in hell that you were innocent, you'd be looking at life." Outside of court, Sierra's family briefly spoke with the media.
"Our hope through this painful process was to find justice for Sierra. Justice for her abduction and murder, justice for our family, and justice for the amazing community that so many of us live in. I want to express to you how pleased we are that justice has been served today, and this murderer was found guilty on all counts."
In July of 2018, Sierra's family acquired the ownership of James's property, and they knocked it down. It had only served as a heartbreaking reminder of what Sierra went through during her last terrifying moments on Earth. In December, Sierra's law passed into the Ohio House of Representatives. It went into effect on the 20th of March, 2019.
"We are still very much advocating Sierra's law. It's Senate Bill 67. It's a violent offender registry. So if they had a database and law enforcement were able to access it, instead of finding her in 3 days, would they have found her in 24 hours, 48 hours? Would that made a difference in finding her alive versus finding her dead? So to me, it's huge. And there's national databases for everything. Why not this?"
The grim murder of Sierra Jochen left deep scars in the rural community of Delta. Many locals said that in the aftermath of the murder, they felt as though their security was completely lost. The evidence of her murder still sits beside the isolated cornfield where her purple bicycle was found, in the form of crosses, flowers, and trinkets. Despite the heartbreak that came with Sierra's murder, her family find comfort in knowing that her sacrifice could save lives with Sierra's Law. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big, massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Leanne, James, Jason, Ron, and Heather. In return for your support on Patreon, you get exclusive Morbidology merch, exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, bonus content for some episodes, ad-free and early release episodes. You can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. You can join for as little as $1 a month, and there are no obligations. You can cancel any time. I'd also like to remind everybody that I'm doing live streams up on the free app Stereo. Just click the link in my show notes, follow me, and you'll be able to see the schedule for upcoming live shows. It's completely audio-based, you don't have to go on camera. And when I'm live, you can join in by chatting with me. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Murder Mile. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hey friends, I'm Michael, host of the Murder Mile UK True Crime Podcast. I would be delighted if you joined me every Thursday for a walk through the untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders of London's West End. Featuring hundreds of fascinating true crime tales you won't hear anywhere else. If you're looking for something different, the award-winning and highly acclaimed Murder Mile UK True Crime Podcast is researched using the original police files. It's presented as a dramatization. Each episode is crafted as a labor of love, and it focuses on the victims' lives in an honest, detailed, and sympathetic way. Season 5 has just begun, so why not treat yourself to more than 150 episodes? If that sounds like your cup of tea, search for the Murder Mile UK True Crime Podcast. Thank you.